This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, but of course, all eyes on the Middle East as we try to find out what we're going to be doing next. There's going to be a lot of action on Capitol Hill today. They're going to be talking about Joe Biden's mental health, what he was doing and not doing. They're also going to be looking at the big, beautiful bill and breaking that down, along with Pete Hegseth going to Capitol Hill to justify his budget or make some requests and answer a lot of questions about what is next when it comes to Iran. So we have this hour joined by Rich Lowry, National Review. Put that in perspective. And we'll also get Doug Collins, the 12th Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He's going to be here talking about the reality of revamping that organization and what DOGE has done and not done. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
On the SALT deduction, here's the challenge we face. Is it that $40,000 cap that's proposed by the House is a way that red states who have lower taxes and more restrained spending subsidize high-tax, high-spending blue states.
Senator Steve Daines weighing in. The big, beautiful bill kicking up dust in a bare-knuckle battle for a compromise. We have the latest in with many in the House, why many in the House will not be happy about the version they get back.
Number two.
It's pretty clear what every single one of these Democrats is doing. What they want is their photo op. They want their headline, and they want the propaganda that feeds into their narrative. It's not working because all of the American people see right through it, and it's completely inauthentic.
Yep, that is true. We're talking about immigration. President Trump has literally sealed the border and is calling an audible on illegals while literally the Dems are physically fighting the crackdown.
Number one.
This issue that in the end there would be this deep, deep underground Iranian facility at Fordo that could only be taken out by a U.S. weapon. And we're now on the edge of that. Trump seems still uncertain what he wants to do. He should be uncertain. It's a big, big choice. One of the most consequential of his presidency.
Dave Ignatius, great knowledge and contacts in the Middle East, weighing in from the Washington Post. It's on. And we may be at war with Israel and Iran. On Israel's side, of course, we're in the sixth day, and it looks like Trump is looking to finish what the IDF started as the Grand Ayatollah still talks tough insulted President Trump's intellect in his latest statement video address last night. We have no idea where he is, but it seems like the president does. He's now talking about backing up. He's talking about finishing him off. He's not talking about compromise or going to talks. He's not talking about coming to a deal. He's talking about surrender. Let's bring in Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Rich, how do you characterize the president's new tone?
Well, it's much more bellicose. He likes to be associated with success. This has been a successful operation so far. And there's something he's just been – one of the things he's been totally consistent on for years and years, going back at least to 2011. I saw a tweet yesterday from Trump when he was a civilian, is that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. So you have some people in MAGA, oh, this is betraying the America First movement. No, he's been totally clear about this. If you voted for him and didn't want him to actually follow through on this, you shouldn't have voted for him because this was clearly one of his priorities. So I don't know which way he's going to go, but certainly if you're the Ayatollah, you have to be much more nervous where the U.S. is today than where it was, say, over the weekend.
So with J.D. Vance really speaks for that MAGA wing who doesn't want the president to do anything. Says this, look, I'm seeing this from the inside and admittedly biased towards our president and my friend. And there's a lot of crazy stuff on social media, so I want to address some things directly on Iran. First, POTUS has been amazingly consistent 10 years, as you mentioned, that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. Second, I've said a lot of confusion over the issue of civilian nuclear power and uranium enrichment. There are distinct issues. Iran can have nuclear power without enrichment. But Iran rejected that. And, of course, people are the right to be worried about foreign entanglements after the last 25 years, what he says are idiotic foreign policy. But I believe the president has earned some trust on this issue. And having seen this up close and personal, I assure you that he's only interested in using the American military to accomplish the American people's goals. Whatever he does, this is his focus. Who's he talking to?
Well, he's talking to the MAGA critics of this war and potential U.S. involvement, and just you know, opening the door. I read that tweet and I'm like, whoa, okay, they're really considering getting involved, because there's no way J.D. Vance is going to be sending out a post like that that leaves open that option very explicitly, unless it's something being actively considered.
No question. And they had an 80-minute meeting yesterday, and then he had a conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I was able to speak to the president yesterday, and he said the Iranians have reached out to him again. He goes, I don't know really what there is to say. I've said it. So they don't really want to talk. They don't want to talk about a consortium to enrich uranium. They're done. And I think we're at the point now where the president says, we just got to finish this off. Maybe, Rich, you had a unique perspective writing about this consistently. Since the hostages were taken in 79, you were younger. We were all young. But we've grown up with this.
I wasn't quite writing yet.
46-year enemy. This is Iran's not new to the. It's not a Trump problem. It's not an Obama problem. But the approach of Obama and Biden made things a whole lot worse, in my view.
Yeah. And Iran's approach for decades, very successful, was that they'd have proxies around the region, and the proxies would wage war against the United States. The proxies would wage war against Israel. And we or Israel would hit the proxies, and we'd have to tangle with the proxies. But meanwhile, the viper's nest, you know, back in Iran would be left mostly harmless, not entirely. You know, there are sanctions, there are Israeli strikes occasionally. And now, finally, after October 7th, proxy after proxy has fallen thanks to Israel. And then the air defenses were knocked out, and then they're left completely defenseless against this sort of attack. And now Israel has really grasped the nettle. And the question is whether we're going to come in as well. You know, I think it'd be better for us if Israel just finished the job if they can. But that's the big question. Can they do Fordo? Can they go deep enough in these underground facilities? And it may be that's where they need us. And no military action is riskless. You know, there are always surprises. But the risk reward calculus here has shifted way towards reward, just given how depleted the ballistic missile stocks are, how there are no air defenses. So it's got to be really tempting, potentially in one bomber run, for Donald Trump to take care of the nuclear program.
They said it would take more than one bomb. They said it would take two. And then I asked last night, what about three? And they go, yeah, it might take three. And if you're going to drop two, why not make sure you got it all? Here's what Michael Doran said from the Hudson Institute, Cut 20.
The thing that the Israelis most want from the Americans are B-2 bombers and the massive ordnance penetrator. That's the 30,000-pound bombs that can actually break through the concrete encasing in the Fordo facility, which is buried under a mountain. The Israelis don't have the ability to bomb Fordo. They would have to go in on the ground and actually occupy it with troops. We have the ability to do that, but we don't give those capabilities to anyone, not to any ally ever. So we would have to do it ourselves.
And I'm just shocked. While we do this, the rest of the region, Rich, is pretty quiet. You know, I see the King of Jordan say something, and you know, I saw warnings from different leaders. You know, the China leader, this is not the way to handle conflict. Like, we're going to listen to them. Vladimir Putin saying something idiotic, like, I'd like to still broker peace between the two sides. Is there anyone less qualified? But for the most part, people are watching, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, no one this side of Hezbollah wants Iran to get a nuclear weapon. No one in the region wants it. Certainly the Sunni Gulf states don't want it. Even China and Russia don't want it because they think these people are crazy and it's a huge risk, right? So this is why, you know, the German chancellor and the Germans have not been friendly towards Israel over the years or to supportive of the war in Gaza, or at least how it's been carried out. So they're doing the dirty work for the rest of us, and that's really true.
Yeah, it really is. And so far it's they've probably been more successful than even Israelis had hoped, as they tried, I think, to do the Western world a big favor. So how do you view the MAGA wing? Because they're pushing back. People like Steve Bannon and others saying, you know, this is not what the president should be doing, Candace Owens and others. How do you feel about that?
You know, they have big audiences, but they're just nothing compared to Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump runs his administration. Donald Trump runs MAGA. Donald Trump is the locus in the center of this movement. No media entity, no influencer, no politician can compare. So if he decides to do this and he makes the case the Republican Party and the vast majority of MAGA will swing around behind him. The polling a couple months ago was, I think, 69% of Republicans supported strikes on Iran if they're developing a nuclear weapon. So that'll go even higher if Trump does it and successful. So it's an interesting debate. There is a fissure there, but this is a faction. This is not the entirety of the movement. This is not the movement splitting in half or the movement ending, as some people have been saying. I think all that's ridiculous.
It's totally ridiculous. Where are they going to go? Is Kamala Harris hiring? I'm not sure. So the big, beautiful bill is they're working on it hard in the Senate. They want to get it done by the 4th. We got the Majority Leader Thune on our show today. Here's what Steve Daines said about the progress they're making. Cut 34.
The bottom line is this. Republicans are trying to save Medicaid. We want to strengthen Medicaid. Well, the Democrats are trying to drain Medicaid. So the reforms that we are proposing, what you just described there in so-called provider tax, that's just a scheme that are used by the states to actually get more dollars from the federal government. This is one of the fastest growing entitlements currently in federal spending. It's designed to protect those who are most vulnerable. It's an important safety net, but we've got to reform Medicaid if we're going to save Medicaid. We've got to take able-bodied males who are laying on the couches at home and get them back to work and off of Medicaid. As an example, put a work requirement in, and the reforms we have made, we think, are reasonable. And it's, again, the way we save this very important safety net.
But you have Senator Josh Hawley go, yeah, we can't touch that. And Rand Paul says, you have to blow that up. It's not enough cuts there. And then Tom Tillis, don't touch that. When it comes to, the House and the salt tax, I'm not going to bore everyone with it, but the state and local taxes, they want to be able to write off Republicans in blue states. So the debate. You've seen this stuff before. You see the size of this bill, 1,000 pages. What would you like to see happen, Rich Lowry?
I like the current version, with the serious Medicaid reforms, but I don't think that's going to get through the House. I think that will be watered back down again, and there'll be just a split the baby difference, whatever the Senate number is on salt and whatever the House number presumably is higher. They'll just split the baby on that, and this is going to be messy. It's been messy at this point, a lot of messiness ahead. And then, as I've said many times before, it'll be, the day before Thanksgiving or whatever, longer than what any of us expect, 2 a.m. on the House floor, not knowing whether they have the votes for final passage, and Trump will be on the phone with the 4 or 5 members still on the fence and convince them all to jump and vote for it, and the thing will pass.
And then we'll see what happens.
Imperfect bill. Yeah. It'd be better, if they had 20-vote margin in the House and 6-vote margin in the Senate, it'd look different and look much better, but that's not the world we're in.
It's not. And then we'll see. The success of that bill will decide the success either party will have at the midterms. But right now, the Democrats are the utter definition of disarray and embarrassment. Ilhan Omar saying we're the worst country in the world. Oh. That's their leader. Good luck with that. Ro Khanna ripping Schumer. So, guys, have at it. Rich Lowry said.
The going out of the way to get arrested. It's just ridiculous.
I mean, the senator crying on the Senate floor yesterday. Oh. And then you had Brad Lander trying to protect an illegal immigrant, get thrown in, cuffed, and loved every minute of it. That's something he's got to work out with his therapist. Rich, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brian. Talk soon.
All right, listen, we got a lot going on today. We got the big three and so much more. And there's also going to be trial about Joe Biden's decline. I don't know what they're going to accomplish, but little by little, they're going to establish what the press was complicit in. Friends and family and the press making sure Joe Biden won re-election and was able to hold that job without being able to do it. And that is terrible. Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
When the president took the oath of office, he took the oath to defend and protect the Constitution and the country. I think a lot of times when people run for office, they say things. They campaign on platitudes and rally speeches. I give the president a lot of credit. I think he's taken this moment very, very seriously. I was reminded of a Churchill saying, I no longer listen to what people say, I watch what they do, because behavior never lies. And I think the president's come to the conclusion because he's tried, other presidents have tried. I hope he's not persuaded by or even impacted by politics. When you mix national security and politics, you normally get bad results.
So Harold Ford, again, showing why he's a fantastic host, and a lot of people at Fox would vote for him if he ever ran for president, just says, look, this is a time which you got to back the president, and I trust his instincts on this, and he's doing what he said he's going to do. We all know that. Even if you didn't vote for him, you know, but they would never say it. But Harold Ford is on The Five yesterday and says the facts. Meanwhile, Israel, as you know, is hammering Iran's centrifuges. They were beating up on two different sites last night all over Tehran. And now the Ayatollah hopped on television yesterday or on tape and rejected President Trump's demand for an unconditional surrender. Quote, the U.S. president threatened us with this absurd rhetoric. He demands that the Iranian people surrender to him. They should make threats against those who are afraid of being threatened. The Iranian nation isn't frightened by such threats, Khamenei wrote the post on X. My sense is there's been so many of his aides killed that he probably had to jot that down on his own. And put it into the prompter on his own, because he's had so many commanders, nuclear scientists, CUDS leaders, all killed, targeted, and wiped out. What is it like knowing that he could have been killed had Trump not preserved his life? He's 86 years old. Next time you see him, he might be in Russia. That's what I think. And by the way, Trump's not going to like that statement, just knowing Trump. Senator Ted Cruz on the threats and the changing texture of this conflict. Cut six.
President Trump throughout this conflict has been fantastic. I spoke to the president on Sunday and just told him, I said, your leadership has been so critical on this. And he made clear Iran is not getting a nuclear weapon, and he is standing with Israel. I believe our position should be we stand unequivocally with the state of Israel. And I'll make a point. Israel is doing an enormous favor to the United States right now. I believe the most acute near-term security threat facing America is the threat of a nuclear Iran, because the Ayatollah is a religious nutcase.
So we're probably going to be looking at, by the way, Doug Collins coming up shortly. We're going to be looking at if we're going to get involved. And it looks like indications are we are, unless Israel says, I got the plan already, I don't need you. We're going to take a B-2 stealth bomber designed to carry 30,000-pound GBUs, what they call them, the nicknames Bunker Busters, Mother of All Bombs, whatever you want. And they're going to drop one, maybe two, and they're going to do it through B-2s. Last night, we heard it could be B-52, judging by the threat on the ground, which I don't think is great, but who knows. And number three, they could take it from the C-130s, because you just need a big plane to drop a big bomb. At which point, it doesn't just hit and explode, it'll detonate when they choose to detonate it, and that'll be as deep as it can get. One goes deep, makes a big hole, the next one in goes out and finishes the job. Meantime, you know who's going to lose big time? Russia's going to lose an ally, and China's going to lose Iran as an oil supplier at a discount rate. I was struck to see that 90% of Iran's oil exports go to China. They export 1.7 million barrels of crude a day, less than 2% of the global demand. The U.S. reimposed sanctions on Tehran's oil exports in 2018. Of course, Joe Biden loosened everything up and let it all happen. And instead of saying, wow, aren't the U.S. great? They said, aren't they suckers? And he refused to talk to Joe Biden. And then they thought that Trump was bluffing. I believe they were in for a huge surprise. Everybody has a right to be critical and worried. But I also think the flip side should make you more worried if we ignored this opportunity.
Power, politics, and the people behind the headlines. I'm Miranda Devine, New York Post columnist and the host of the brand new podcast, Podforce One. Every week, I'll sit down for candid conversations with Washington's most powerful disruptors, lawmakers, newsmakers, and even the president of the United States. These are the leaders shaping the future of America and the world. Listen to Podforce One with me, Miranda Devine, every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. You don't want to miss an episode.
All A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, everybody, and welcome back. I come to you from New York, but guess who's in town? Doug Collins, 12th Secretary of Veterans Affairs. We had him in as a congressman. We had him in as a civilian. And we know, are you still in the Guard?
I'm still in the reserves.
Yep. You're still in the reserves?
Yeah, I'm still in the reserves.
How many years is this now?
I'm going on 24.
Wow. And, of course, a lot of people just are saying to me, I was talking to some official, Michael Whatley.
Yeah.
And I was just saying, what are you going to do in Georgia now that Governor Brian Kemp's not running? I said, what are you going to do in New Hampshire now that Sununu says he's not going to run? And they said, well, we think in Georgia, Doug Collins, but he's got a job.
Yeah, I've got a job. Thanks, Michael.
So you are the 12th Secretary of Veterans Affairs. How's it been going?
It's been going great. I love the job, love working for the president, doing this, taking care of veterans. And, you know, I think it's been sort of prime. Me and you, we've been on TV and fighting against, you know, falsehoods. That's what I do all the time right now, is just fighting against the falsehood.
This should be an apolitical office.
It should be, and I want it to be. I've reached out across the aisles. I said, my bottom line is the VA is going to take care of veterans. That's our only purpose. But yet it has become such a large, ingrained bureaucratic organization that Congress only knows how to deal with it over the last number of years by putting money and people at it.
Right.
And so there becomes this investment that it becomes, you know, workforce development. And it's not. We're about service. So it's one of those things where I jokingly say, and truthfully, we got 535 board of directors. All of them want to say that they're for veterans, but yet if the minute something goes wrong or something changed, they don't want to see anything happen.
So you say 500, but because you're talking about lawmakers.
Yeah, right? I'm talking about Congress.
So you're talking about your lawmakers. So there's a story out right now you just handed me. Extremely disturbing and unethical. New rules allow VA doctors to refuse to treat Democrats and unmarried veterans. How much truth is in this story?
Zero. It's just a flat-out lie.
Yeah.
This is The Guardian now has undoubtedly decided that it's about on the same level as the gossip column in a middle school magazine.
A British left-wing newspaper.
Yes.
We need one.
Right, exactly. They started this out on another angle with this story. We killed that part of the story because they finally at least understood that wasn't true. Then they actually went to this. We have told them repeatedly. The White House has told them. We've told them. We have did everything we could to say this is a false story. The bylaw changes. There's no way we can, by federal law or policy, keep people out.
So here's an example. They say the medical staff are still required to treat veterans regardless of race, sex, color, religion, and sex. Okay, got it. And all veterans remain entitled to treatment. But individual workers are now free to decline to care for patients based on personal characteristics?
No. No, it's just I don't know another word out of no in English language, and a no is a complete statement. But this is what we have. Their own investigators, their own internal editors are now doing an investigation in this. We have shown them so bad. Mm-hmm. We would love for them to retract it, which what needs to happen. But here's the problem with this, Brian. It's not just that it's a bad article. It's not just it's false. If we have had members of Congress, Senator Patty Murray, we've actually had Marcy Kaptur out of Ohio, who've retweeted this, basically claiming it to be true and asking for me, you know, to say, why are you doing this? Well, we're not doing anything. My concern is these kind of random reports that show up on social media. What does it say to a veteran out there who may have had a bad experience with the VA, or they were just thinking about going to the VA, and they see something like this? They don't have any context for truth. They may not hear me today on your show, and they don't go to the VA. They need to get help for depression or something else they're going on. These senators and these representatives and this paper are putting veterans at risk for not getting the treatment they need.
So is it true that you let go of thousands on DOJ's recommendations?
No.
Who have you let go?
Really, at this point, very few, if any. And I think because the only thing we came through with probationaries, which were put back, you know, by the courts, which we're still under a court order. We've done no RIF because the court right now is held us
what
up.
What is RIF?
RIF is reduction in force. And we were looking, we've had, here's
you the, thought the force was unwieldy.
It is. It is unwieldy. And I think, now we've had a good many folks take the early retirement, which is positive. If they wanted to take it, that's great. But here's the understanding. 470,000 people, we're about 460 now, 1,000 employees. We're bigger than the U.S. Army active duty. And we have 170 hospitals, 1,200 clinics. We do 9.1 million enrolled veterans. But here's the interesting thing. The budget for the VA in the last 10 years has increased by hundreds of billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of employees in 10 years, and yet we're still at 9.1 enrolled since 10 years ago.
What do you mean 9.1?
That's 9.1 million veterans are enrolled in our system. So think about this. the way that Congress has reacted to some things has put lots of money in people, but yet the number for veterans has stayed the same. Utilization is up in some areas, especially the South and others, where people taking advantage of things. PACT Act had some to do with that, the burn pit issue, but just a little. But we still had wait times that were too high. The Biden administration did away basically with the Mission Act, where you could go get community care, which President Trump had put in, and I've actually voted on in Congress. They weren't letting folks go to the community, which was basically a violation of the law that they were supposed to. We've changed that now to where they get back easier to the community so we can get them quicker.
So in other words, if they say, there's no VA near me, can I use the money to go to my local doctor?
Well, it is. Or there was, and now we've instituted a standard that our doctors can go back to best medical interest. So they don't have to necessarily see, is there a wait time or is there, but it's the best medical interest between the doctor and the patient to say, look, you can get this cardiologist, you can get this urologist. We don't have what we need at this point. We want you to go see this person. And then the other thing is the same amount of money, same amount of people. We had a backlog of 260,000 disability claims that are processed for people to get their disability. 260,000 backlog, which means they're over 125 days old.
Wow.
When I stepped into the office, we're now down to 190, right below 190 in less than 60 days. We put a focus on it. That means that we're clearing out cases, that we're doing more than we've ever had. We're doing it with people who have taken early time, but we're doing it with a focus, again, on getting a veteran care. That was missing when I got there, Brian. The emphasis was on our employee base. The emphasis was on what are we doing, what are our policies, instead of the main only reason we exist is a veteran walking through the front door.
All right, so, and your goal is to get a deputy, an undersecretary. You have no staff.
Yeah, deputy is, of confirmed Senate people, I've got my deputy, and we got him about 8 weeks in, and I've only had him a couple months. But I do not have a CFO. I do not have a general counsel. And I think you've actually interviewed Sam Brown from Senate. Sam is a great guy. He's going to run our cemetery association. Gallego and Blumenthal have decided that they're going to block all of our nominees.
Why?
Because they don't like me and don't like the president. That's bottom line.
But the first round you got through, and Secretary of State, we get all these people through. But everyone took their eye off the ball because it's not the sexy deputy undersecretary, aren't the big names.
Right.
So they're slowing it down, making it totally ineffective.
And you
went through the committee part.
Yeah. The three that I just mentioned, by the way, all are veterans. So it's sort of hypocritical for Gallego and Blumenthal to talk about, we need to do all this for veterans, but yet you're not letting these, which they could, on UC, they could just let them go. These are lower level positions, but they refuse to let it happen. And so we're stuck in this, and it's putting the leader in Thune in a bad position. He's trying to get through as many as he can, but if you're having to burn floor time, which is what the Democrats are making them do, then it just takes up everything. So they're having to do one or two or three a week, and that's all they're getting.
Which is crazy. And the other thing is they had the big, beautiful bill. You know what it's like to have an overwhelming piece of legislation.
Oh, yes.
So that's what happens because you're using that time.
Because we're into the big part of that now. Think about this, Brian.
So what does Senator Thune say to you when you say, listen, I need my guy?
I think they're working as hard as they can.
Okay.
And the president knows this. Again, though, it's really one of those things. I'm going to say something that some will agree with and some won't. I think there's got to become a time in our country that the president who wins the presidency, they get their cabinet members, unless there's a problem. I agree, having a hard hearing, that's fine. But they get their cabinet members. And then we need to decide on the top 300, top 400 of political appointees that the Congress has decided these have to be approved, that they go through.
Because it's a national security interest.
It could be, two that we haven't even talked about, because I had to do a process before I could ever get my deputy in. Undersecretary for Health, which is our VA, which are all of our health care centers, all of our clinics, all of our health, is Senate confirmable. After I got the deputy in, they had to do a commission, which is, again, it's the craziest kind of thing. So now we finally got him. John Bartram's name's been sent to the Senate. We have our Veterans Benefit Associate, our second business line, which does all the benefits. Those are two undersecretaries that at the rate we're going now, I may get them by October.
October. It's absolutely insane.
May, and that's a hope.
Totally unacceptable. And lastly, you talk about there was an executive order signed to address veteran homelessness and the actions you've taken. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems. It's usually most people on the street, we've all learned, have some type of psychological issue. It's not a money issue.
Yep.
How do you address that?
They're
not coming to you. You got to go find them.
No, we got to find them. And one of the areas, the president took this on in his executive order, we have a huge campus in L.A. And right now, unfortunately, because of the riots and the malpractice of Newsom and the mayor of letting the riots go, I have an ambulatory clinic that's been closed for a week. Over 1,800 appointments have been affected. We got people who can't go to see their doctors, and we're having to reschedule appointments. We got a regional office, which does benefits, is closed. But right down the street from that is the campus of West LA. And what we're going to be doing, we already have housing made there. This has come out of a couple of legal cases. But what we found going back a number of years under Obama and others coming forward is we actually signed away part of our property to a private school and also to a baseball field for UCLA. So facilities we have that we could have used to expand our treatment for homelessness and getting people in, getting them better, getting back, we sort of, I believe, wrongly gave away. The courts have said this as well. So the president said, let's go into that area. Let's put more housing in there. Let's get more transition so that we can affix the root causes of them being homeless. L.A. is one of our largest places in the country, 3,000 projected homeless veterans in L.A.
Wow.
So it's a place for us.
So let's talk about some of the turbulence in the inner cities, the blue cities, which you guys in Georgia probably, you can understand it. Some of your cities are pretty liberal. But I think that Chicago's as bad as it gets. And they are pushing back against Trump because he's trying to crack down on the sanctuary cities. Here's the mayor talking about what his approach is. This guy with an 18% approval rating, cut 30.
Yeah, let me just first acknowledge the level of anxiety and fear and trepidation that this administration has caused. You've never seen a society improve or expand under this type of fear. And we're going to continue to resist, and we're going to do it in many different ways, whether it's taken to the streets or to the courts or policy.
So he's talking about the immigration policies, illegal immigrants on the street. He's going to fight back every step of the way. Brad Lander in New York City literally kept blocking a illegal immigrant from being scooped up by ICE, so they arrested him.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Well, the question is in a legal format, when you're arresting somebody that is under a legal arrest, is being made, and you step in, I don't care what the issue of crime is, you're going to be, if you're obstructing justice, you need to be
that as a lawmaker.
Yeah, it is. As a lawmaker, I mean, as a father of, my dad was a state trooper, he'll tell you real quickly, I'm making the arrest, you get in it, you're going to be with them. And I think that's the obstruction. But imagine, I mean, I really would love to get the mayor of Chicago and some of these other mayors in a room, off camera, no microphones, and say, do you really believe what you're saying? Do you really sit there and say the law-abiding citizens of your city who came, and immigrants who came here legally, you're telling them you'll throw it all away?
Yes.
For people who decided to break the law and come here illegally.
So here's
it's amazing.
Yeah, this African-American Chicago resident that came on with me last night. I was hosting for Laura. I'm doing that again tonight. And I asked him to comment on that. I rolled that very soundbite in. And here's what he said, cut 31.
Since Donald Trump has been sworn into office, there has been over 1,300 daily ICE arrests that has been happening all across the country. That's over 100%. That's absolutely amazing. So this is what the people voted for, patriots like myself. And it's a shame that J.B. Pritzker doesn't allow law enforcement to do their job and help out ICE getting these illegal criminals out of our cities and whatnot, which makes you wonder, what the hell is really wrong with these Democratic officials that's going on in our country? They're letting out illegal migrants and criminals out of the back door and things like that. You even have protesters that was at this No Kings protest in Chicago and L.A. and New York, which I attended, by the way. I even asked some of these liberals, what did Donald Trump ever do that was bad? Or what is your criticism of Donald Trump? They couldn't even tell me. So these people are absolutely insane. And this is just another Democratic playbook that J.B. Pritzker wants to do.
And Doug, the reason why I want you to hear this as Secretary, is because you're in the middle of the whole Russian scam thing. You were unwound it before the Mueller report came out. You figured it out.
Yep.
So they came out. Then you had to go and drill that. And you could see these people, whether they believe it or not, they are just something about Trump drives them crazy. These guys are over the top crazy because they think Trump is the problem. But the American people see there's logic and common sense at the foundation of his actions.
It's amazing to me to look at a political situation and stepping out as Doug, as you said, I'm just, and this is my observation. I read this a quote the other day. Here we go again down the other side, taking a 20% issue over an 80% issue. And not to say that 80% is all, is every fully right, but you at least got to think about, what are you doing here? And the president sits here and he looks at it, he says, you came here illegally. This goes back to what I think a lot of folks said is a more political issue. Mm-hmm. This is a more political long-term gain issue. Remember, in the nuts and bolts away from the headlines, you get more of the illegal immigrants into these areas, get them counted in the census, get mm-hmm. them counted in the arena. That is what's funding the federal programs. It's what's funding a lot of the monies that go back to these states that they actually turn around and give to the – and then it in turn mm-hmm. Funds the Democratic – process and getting them possibly to vote or later into doing that. So this is, again, it's just mm-hmm. amazing that we're trading. I mean, sovereignty is a big issue here. I never see the same politicians here say Germany or others or Mexico, why do you have a border? Why can't I just go into your country and do it? They don't ever ask that question.
Because nobody does. Try it in Russia. It'll go sure. China's wide open to that. A few more minutes with Doug Collins, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think the most important thing is when you are in a leadership position like that, is that you are inclusive and that you work together with everybody. And so it means that you have to work together with local government, the state government, and the federal government. They have to work together rather than fighting each other.
Arnold Schwarzenegger weighing in about refusing to play into the Views game of isn't Donald Trump terrible, fill in the blank. He also, when it came out to immigration, he was extremely strong and grateful to be an American. Cut 33.
As an immigrant yourself, you are an immigrant. You're an immigrant in this country.
Yeah.
Did you have a visceral reaction to what they're doing, what ICE is doing, when you see the videos of it?
We got to do things legal. That is the important thing, you know. So you got to do things legal. And those people that are doing illegal things in America and they're the foreigners, they are not smart. Because when you come to America, you're a guest. And you have to behave like a guest.
Yes, I'm so sorry. Doug Collins, in a few more minutes with you. That's the way a immigrant, grateful, great American talks.
How many times have you heard this, Brian, from folks who came here legally? They did it the right way. They come in and say, look, do this the right way. And I'm surprised the View can even continue, but hey, everybody needs a false comedy.
Your administration shut down the border. I thought it was impossible without the wall being built. Zero got in last month. A million people self-deported on a $1,000 incentive. And for the first time, we're going to have more people leave than come.
Yep.
And then we're going to decide, I hope, to have a work visa situation that allows us to fill the gap on these jobs in an organized way.
Yeah, isn't it amazing that we were told for 4 years that the president couldn't do anything? Isn't it amazing?
World migration.
Except for one thing. They could open the gates.
Yes.
That's one thing they could do. They could open the gates.
And they said, look, the whole world is migrating into them. Really? I didn't know that. The Chinese and pocket protectors need to come here.
Yeah, they didn't have it.
Doug Collins, you're doing a great job. 12th Secretary of Veterans Affairs. I look forward to you getting a staff confirmed.
Yes, we're looking forward to it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Mr. Secretary. Back in a moment.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. I come to you from 48th and 6th, Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country and around the world. Ian Bremmer at the bottom of the hour, the president and founder of Eurasia Group. Great perspective on our challenges overseas. President of the United States is meeting right now to announce the building from his own pocket of two flagpoles on either side of the White House. But then he does what he does best, opens up the phone and takes any question possible. I don't need to tell you how different he is than President Biden, but for 4 years, you get one question with the chopper in the background. He talks to you 3 or 4 times a day when he's in town. So, and when someone like Rachel Scott, who tried to destroy him at a campaign event for black journalists, and Dana Bash, who beats up on him almost every single day, when they need to speak to him, he picks up the phone. So at one point, the press is going to say, yeah, he's tough on us, but at least he gives us access, and you know exactly what he's thinking. Joining us now is Senate Majority Leader John Thune. Senator Thune, your life's changed dramatically, taking over from Mitch McConnell. I got it. But how different is it being with this administration on a daily basis and factor in the new job you have?
Well, Brian, you know, every day is a new adventure, and there isn't hardly a day goes by where you don't have something coming at you that you didn't expect to happen. And I think that's obviously what the president and the White House have been dealing with what's happening on the global stage. Obviously, a lot going on here at home as well. But the thing I'll tell you is the president is somebody who thrives under pressure, has a tremendous amount of stamina, and willingness to do the hard work to get good results and good outcomes for the country. And I think right now you're seeing the effects of that as he continues to navigate and manage what is a very difficult, complex, and dangerous world, and at the same time balance everything that's going on here at home, including the work that we're doing up here in Capitol Hill. He's enormously involved in just the day-to-day aspects of trying to make sure that the agenda we're putting forward is a good one for the American people.
The Ayatollah is not only surrendering, he basically insulted the president's intellect with his statements, says he has no intention of backing off, and if we get involved, they're going to go for our assets, according to two separate people. So Khomeini, even though he has almost no cards to play, if I could use the president's term, is just as belligerent as ever. How do you characterize it?
I think that's right. I mean, I think he's very defiant, very belligerent, and he's cornered right now. His offensive capability has been dramatically diminished by the Israelis, and I think increasingly he is feeling cornered. So, you know, I'm hoping what that leads to eventually is an acknowledgement and realization that their current strategy isn't going anywhere, and it's just going to lead to more death and destruction for his people. And the way to achieve a positive outcome here for his countrymen is to actually come to the table and negotiate a deal that ends their nuclear program, and that's what President Trump wants to achieve. But we'll just see how willing he is to do that. But every day they take more of a beating from the Israeli Defense Forces, and it seems like it's only a matter of time until they have no choices. But, you know, at least right now, I think the president is keeping his options open and prepared to do what it takes to ensure that that Iran never has a nuclear capability.
Senator Thune, lastly, when it comes to the War Powers Act, Senator Tim Kaine says, if you're going to go in, Mr. President, you have to get permission from the Senate first. And the House, your thoughts about the president getting permission if we're to maybe blow up Fordo?
You know, I think my view on that, and I think that it's probably the view, I would say, probably of most of the legal scholars. Obviously, the Democrats here on Capitol Hill probably have a different view, but that's grounded in their Trump derangement syndrome. They want to strip him of all the powers. I think that in this particular case, at least, the president has all the authority he needs. I mean, he's responding to a time of national crisis where American troops, service members are very possibly could be in harm's way under attack. And he has tremendous latitude as the commander in chief to respond to circumstances like that. So, you know, the Tim Kaine resolution is maybe good politics for him and the progressive left in the country. But for most of Americans who are concerned in a safer, stronger, and more prosperous world, and certainly a safer, stronger, and more prosperous America, I think they have a lot of confidence that the president will make the right decision.
So Thomas Massie is somebody else teaming up with members of the squad to say this is not our war, and he wants the president to come to him. He's a Republican.
Yeah, I mean, and there are going to be some voices like that. You know, we have a few like that in the Senate. There are some, you know, folks who are in the isolationist wing of our party who don't believe that the U.S. has a role when it comes to what's happening on the world stage.
Yep.
But we very much have a role, particularly when it comes to Israel, our most trusted ally, certainly in the Middle East, arguably in the world. And we have a vested interest not only in their success and security, but also how closely that's related to ours. As it's been very clear from the outset that Iran sees, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has said this, the only thing standing between Iran and the United States is Israel. So this has enormous security implications for our country and for the world, and the U.S. Rightfully has an important leadership role to play in that.
I hope we do take action. Let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. You're working hard to get something, I guess, back to the House because you're making changes by the 4th of July. The CBO yesterday estimated they would increase the budget deficit by as much as $2.8 slightly up. They released a dynamic score of President Trump's one big, beautiful bill. So that means the deficit slightly higher under what they're seeing that you guys are putting out. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, Brian, I think that the scorekeepers around here, the Congressional Budget Office and others, have been notoriously bad in terms of their record when it comes to making predictions about things like this. And they're never going to give you credit when you cut taxes. The bias in the scorekeepers here in Washington, D.C., as you would expect in Washington, D.C., always favors, there's always a bias in the favor of spending. And, you know, clearly what they're saying is that because we're not going to allow taxes to go up at the end of the year, that that's somehow going to be able to reduce the deficit. And we just don't accept that premise. What happens when you reduce taxes and you incentivize and increase the incentives for investment is people invest, they make money, and they take those realizations and they pay more taxes and government revenue goes up. The standard rule of thumb is for every 1% growth in the GDP, in our gross economic product in this country, we get about $3 trillion in additional tax revenue. So growth leads to revenue, and these are pro-growth policies, and the CBO is never going to give credit for that. So this is the biggest spending reduction in history, coupled with these pro-growth economic policies. That's a recipe, in my view, for a very successful future for our country.
So let's talk about right now some things we have changed. They wanted to be able to write off $40,000 when it comes to the SALT, writing off local taxes. You're like at 10. So that's going to be a reduction. And Mike Lawler on the House side already said, well, that's a non-starter for us. You're also, when it comes to Medicaid expansion, you're looking at the rate in which on reimbursements, you're looking to adjust that. Do you worry about Senate? Have you checked with Senator Josh Hawley, who said, please don't touch Medicaid, who says, refer to the president, he backs me. Maybe you want to clarify where you're going.
Well, you know, what we said, and this is what we are doing, Brian, and I think that, as you see, the policies and the numbers around it reflect that. One, we're not cutting Medicare. We're just slowing the rate of growth. It's going to increase year over year for the next 10 years. It's just not going to grow at as fast a rate. And what we are doing is doing away with the Biden-era waste, fraud, and abuse that was embedded into that program. There are a lot of people today, illegal immigrants, people who aren't eligible for the program, able-bodied male adults who should be working, who are benefiting from Medicaid. Medicaid was not intended for that. So this is getting back to its core mission and making sure that it's serving the population it was designed to serve and reforming and strengthening it in a way that was long overdue from, like I said, many of the failed policies of the Biden administration.
So Rand Paul says, I am not a no yet. He says there's insufficient spending cuts. He's ejected provisions that raise the debt ceiling by $5 trillion. But he says he's willing to work. Have you seen any indication that Rand Paul is willing to work with you?
I'm hoping that in the end, Rand will come around to see this as a dramatic improvement over the status quo. This is the first time, literally in probably a couple of generations, Brian, certainly in several decades, that we're actually starting to spend the growth of the federal government down and that trajectory, leveling it off instead of having it dramatically increase, which is unsustainable. We've got an unsustainable debt. That's good. That's one of the things that obviously people like Rand Paul care deeply about. You couple that with, like I said, the pro-growth policies on taxes and regulations and energy, the generational investment in border security, modernizing our military. There are so many things in here that I think are priorities for a lot of folks, and hopefully in the end we'll be able to keep our Republican team united. And I'd certainly love to see Rand come around in the end to where he feels he can support this. And I think it's consistent with, you know, many of the things that he believes in. And I hope that's the view of all of these Republican United States senators. We'd love to have a united team when it comes time to vote.
Senator, where are you at with the vote now? We have a week left, right?
Yeah, we're not there yet, Brian. I mean, it's a work in progress. And, you know, some of the text is out. Everybody's reacting to it. We're getting suggestions and input and feedback. And we're continuing to work to try and get to that sweet spot that enables us to get 51 in the Senate and that will allow us to get the 218 in the House. And we understand on that SALT issue that you mentioned earlier, obviously we have to negotiate that out and we'll find a way of getting that done. But at the end of the day, failure is not an option. We have to succeed. This is the president's agenda. This is what he ran on. This is what people voted for. And it's incumbent on all of us to try, as much as we may not get everything we want in this thing, to keep rowing right in the same direction and get a positive outcome for the country.
Senator, in the big picture, I know you can't look past a big, beautiful bill this summer, but if you do want it to, if you do want to get the deficit in order and get past the 30 and find a way to pare down the $37 trillion in debt, you got to go to entitlements. That's a very unpopular thing to do for a politician, not for an economist or for somebody who wants to be a pundit. Is there a game plan to do that as the president's term limited out, to go back at the entitlements in a way that's going to effectively get our country solvent again or on the course to solvency again?
Well, we don't have any choice, Brian. We have to. And, you know, it's just like what we're doing with respect to Medicaid. It's waste, fraud, and abuse. It's ways in which these programs have been gamed. And when Democrats are in power, they continue to game them. A lot of the pandemic spending hasn't been unwound. And when Democrats have power, they grow government, they increase spending, they get more people dependent upon government programs. And so now we have to come along. And unwinding it, this stuff isn't easy, but we have to do it because the future of the country depends on it. We can't sustain the kind of debt load that we're carrying today and expect the future generation to have any kind of hopes or aspirations or dreams that those who come before us have enjoyed. So, I mean, we should always look for ways to make government more efficient and effective. And we will be doing that. And if there are ideas that come up, when we say we get this thing done, we get it behind us and pass it, it'll be a huge first step. But there's a lot more to do. And as long as our focus is getting a leaner, more efficient, more effective federal government that rids the, you know, these programs of the waste, fraud, and abuse that have been embedded in some of them for some time, that's a win for the American people. And I think that's what the taxpayers in this country ought to expect.
I want you, the other thing I want to talk to you about is what happened last week with Senator Alex Padilla. I didn't even know what the guy looked like either. I guess he was appointed when the vice president became vice president, Kamala Harris. But he went on Capitol Hill, went to Kristi Noem, security ends up putting him in cuffs. Here he is talking about what he, how he, where he thinks the country's at right now. Cut 29.
It's because the American people have always been willing to speak up and exercise their First Amendment rights to protest, especially when our fundamental rights have been threatened. And as the proud son of immigrants from Mexico, it's that same right that I came to revere when marching through the streets with my family and my friends in 1994.
All right, so he says it's a bigger picture, the way ICE treated him, if they're treating illegal immigrants like that, it's terrible for the country. How do you view what Padilla did and how he was treated?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think a lot of I'm a grandson of an immigrant. I think a lot of us have an immigrant heritage in this country, but we're a nation of laws, and those laws have to be preserved and protected. I mean, our first and fundamentally as a country, that's what differentiates us from every other country in the world, is we adhere to the rule of law. And yes, we have constitutional protections to free speech, which everybody has the opportunity to take advantage of in this country. What happened out there obviously was unfortunate. We're still getting the facts and the details, the information around it. But it clearly, I think, that was a case of mistaken identity. People didn't realize who he was. And but I think we all have a responsibility, Brian, to do what we can to lower the temperature and the emotion around some of these debates in this country. But we have to recognize that law enforcement, people who are enforcing all our laws, including our immigration laws, have a job to do. And that's not an easy job, but we have to respect them when they do it. And obviously, I think as a nation, we are a better place when people understand that the rule of law applies to everybody equally.
I'm pretty sure you should not get that close to the secretary and start screaming. I would expect to be restrained too, even
well,
if I was.
Well, I just think, yeah, and you know, I think obviously there is a. I think there were just people didn't realize who he was, and when they recognized it, who he was, they adjusted. But I think that this was an unfortunate again incident, but there's an awful lot of. I think too much probably being read into it, too many conclusions being drawn from it that perhaps aren't entirely consistent with the facts. I'm always interested in what the facts are. And right now, the fact of the matter is we've got a lot of law enforcement officials in this country who are trying to do a job.
And especially as president in the weekend, it's not easy being a lawmaker these days, too. Senator Majority Leader John Thune. Senator, thanks so much. It's going to be a big battle. Finally, do you predict you're going to get something done before July 4th?
I do. You know, but then I'm kind of a I'm always an eternal optimist, Brian. But I, you know, this stuff is hard. There's a lot of work ahead of us, and we're continuing to sit down, listen, work with. But in the end, we got to get 51. That's the goal.
Go get them, Senator John Thune. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Busy time.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
Our audience really appreciate the time you give us. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
They even suggested they come to the White House. It's a big difference. But they've suggested that they come to the White House. That's, you know, courageous, but, you know, it's like not easy for them to do. But they suggest, because I can't go now because of what's going on. I had to come back early from the G7, which was terrific, by the way, in Canada.
So you said Iran does want to talk. Remember, they were going to meet on Sunday, but they've said before going in, we will never stop enriching uranium instead of spinning centrifuges. We've invested too much time and money doing that. Okay. Well, we told you had to. Why are we wasting five previous, let alone having a sixth round? Now, after getting their head kicked in for the last 6 days, now they say to the president, okay, we're willing to talk. About what? So you could delay more of an attack, so you could preserve more of your nuclear program to try to get public sentiment against the Israelis? There's a huge downside to that. When we come back, I'm going to bring that up with Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group. We'll bring you more from the president's comments just now as he christened, put money out of his pocket to put two flagpoles on both sides of the White House. And then talks to the press. A lot going on. So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
From the beginning of this, there has been concern among U.S. officials that Israel can start a war against Iran, but it can't finish it without U.S. help. That's something that bothered President Trump back in February when Prime Minister Netanyahu first began proposing the kinds of attacks that we've seen beginning last Friday. And Trump was wary of being drawn into something that he wasn't sure was required. He thought that maybe diplomacy could accomplish the same. But this issue, that in the end there would be this deep, deep underground Iranian facility at Fordo, south of Tehran, that could only be taken out by a U.S. weapon, the so-called massive ordnance penetrator, would require American intervention. And we're now on the edge of that, as I said at the beginning. But Trump seems still uncertain what he wants to do, how to make up his mind. He should be uncertain. It's a big, big choice, one of the most consequential of his presidency.
Fair assessment from Dave Ignatius, and I think his reporting is correct about February. And I think the president had a productive conversation 2 weeks ago in Camp David with Netanyahu. He said, give the talks a chance. And I think Witkoff and company are ready to throw in the towel. I mean, Ian Bremmer is the president and founder of Eurasia Group. Ian, he kind of made it easy. I mean, the delegation with the Iranians, they didn't say, let me think about a consortium to where we could enrich uranium outside the country. I'm going to look at the plus. Instead, they just go, no, well, there's no scenario. And the Ayatollah backed up where we don't enrich in country. So that made it easier. And he says, we're never going to stop with the centrifuges. That made it easier. So there was no gray area.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if Trump wanted a short-term deal where they would do much more limited enrichment and then they could continue to talk about a consortium in the future, he could have done that. He could have papered it over and gotten some time with the inspectors there and with the stockpiling taken away. That they were prepared to do, but they were not prepared to accept at any point zero domestic enrichment in Iran. And that was a red line for the Iranians as long as Witkoff was talking with them. And there have been five rounds of talks, as you know. So that combined with the urgency from Israel, not only because they were worried about Iran developing more ballistic missile capabilities and getting closer to nuclear breakout, but also most urgently because Netanyahu's government was about to fall. He was facing a vote of no confidence within a couple days. And so that really made it, you know, a requirement for him to go after the Iranians. And Trump was willing to give him the green light. That's what happened.
You really think that the elections had anything to do with it? Do you think he was making up the fact that they're a week away or they could at any moment make a couple of bombs and turn it into a 500 quickly? You think that was election driven?
Oh, it's partially election driven, of course. I mean, that vote was going to come down against him if he didn't get that war done immediately. And so it's not that he wanted to go to war only because of his domestic concerns. Not at all. Again, the Israeli prime minister has been pushing to strike Iran for years, and especially since taking out Hezbollah. So it's not like this is somehow new for the Iranians. But there's no question that he was going to lose that vote. The far-right parties were leaving his government, and his government was going to fall. And by saying, no, 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 we're striking this week, suddenly those votes were his and his government stayed in place. So he wasn't going to be the leader if he didn't actually get the war done last week.
So do you think that the president is making too much of the intelligence? You think Tulsi Gabbard was right that there was no intelligence, that they want to make a weapon?
The United States, first of all, Gabbard, from everyone I talk to, has been doing a perfectly good job as national intelligence director. And frankly, Trump has been getting more briefings, the presidential daily brief, than Biden was in his last year. He likes the capabilities of the people that are briefing him. And in fact, he even brings them with him on Air Force One, which Biden didn't do. So he's pretty aligned on this stuff. Netanyahu has a history of cherry picking. That's different. It's not that he's lying about intelligence, but he's definitely shading it. He's putting forward stuff that he likes and suppressing stuff that he doesn't. And that's what's in his conversations with Trump. But the United States and Israel work so closely together on intelligence. The Israelis are the ones collecting it, but they don't have the ability to process it. They need the Americans for that. There's way too much data. And so, frankly, the level of mutual engagement and even trust between the U.S. and Israel operationally in intelligence is actually very high. So I don't think Tulsi was, shading it at all. I think she came forward with the best information she had at that point. But when Trump is deciding that he's going to go ahead, then his willingness to exaggerate in a public statement is high, right? We've seen that all the time. He plays fast and loose with numbers and dates and stuff.
So Michael Doran was on with us earlier from the Hudson Institute, and he was describing how much better the relationship is between Trump and Biden, not just personally, but government to government. And he says there was a lot more holding back of weapons outside Hamas and humanitarian efforts than has been let on. But it wouldn't benefit anyone to go publicly. But now they feel they have a partner as different as Donald Trump is to deal with. I wonder what your sources are saying.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think there's been so much talk, and a lot of it was hopeful talk, that, Trump is upset with Netanyahu. Look, he went to the Gulf. He didn't go to Israel. Went there the first time. The Bibi was the first leader that Trump invited to the White House after Liberation Day was announced. And, Trump has his problems with the Israeli PM. He wants the Gaza war over, and the Israeli prime minister hasn't given that to him. He wanted more humanitarian aid in, though it's not exactly a priority, and Bibi has slow-rolled that. But, in terms of a strategic alignment and support from the United States, it's in lockstep. And that military support is there. The intelligence support is there. The billions of dollars of aid every year is there. And at no point has Trump threatened to shut that down the way he did suspend it with the Ukrainians, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't see any white space between the Americans and Israel in terms of the alliance. And I think that's very important for people to understand. And the Europeans do get that, right? They know it. They understand it.
French, you're really critical of Israel when it comes to Hamas. They're talking about two-state solutions, having conferences outside there. But they're on the same page when it comes to the threat of Iran. Here's what General David Petraeus told Martha on our channel, the options that Trump has. Cut 14.
The president, I think, has two big choices. One is to amplify the ultimatum he has already given of unconditional surrender and to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to have complete inspection rights. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to take out the Fordow reactor enrichment complex.
Do you think that we're at that point? Do you agree with those options? And do you think Trump is going to option to go in?
No, there's obviously another option. He doesn't want to talk about it, but there's another option, which is the United States, with the Israelis having destroyed so much of Iran's military capabilities, destroyed so much of their nuclear capabilities, everything above ground. It's only Fordow. And they could, if they wanted to, strike above ground Fordow, including really decimate all of the entrances.
Yep.
And it would take them months and months to dig out. So, I mean, there's no reason why the Americans, there's no urgency for the United States to involve itself directly in the war by striking Fordow this weekend. That does not have to happen. That could happen in months if the Iranians decided that they, you know, refuse after all of these hits. Let the Israelis be bad cop, and then the Americans come in and give them one more chance, knowing that the Iranians can't deter Israel or the United States, knowing that their nuclear site is vulnerable to the Americans hitting it at any point. Why does the U.S. have to do this right now? And potentially risk a desperate Iran making strikes against U.S. servicemen and women that the Americans would have to respond to, or disrupting the Straits of Hormuz, or attacking Gulf refining capabilities, bringing the price of oil to 80, 90, 100 or more. What is the urgency that requires the Americans to do that? Now, the answer is because Trump has just given them an ultimatum, because he's sending all the troops and capabilities there, and because, you know, he doesn't want to look weak. But that's not his you know, vanity is not my reasoning. And so there is obviously a third point here. And I, you know, the Americans are clearly vastly stronger than Iran. So is Israel. That's abundantly clear to everybody. There is no need. The United States has to be involved directly in this war right now themselves. There's no need for that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you're only going to have this type of momentum at one point. Like, Israel's not going to have the momentum and the money to continue bombing for. Now we're up day six. So we're just going to have a major pause, and everyone just sits around and sees what's next?
We can have a pause and see how the Iranians respond now that they've had their top military destroyed and assassinated. And, I mean, what is this momentum of which you speak? What is this money that the Israelis are running out of money and they won't have money to attack in 3 months, in 6 months' time? That just seems to me like a canard.
Do you just stop bombing and just go, okay, we're done for now. Now what do you think?
Well, the Israelis can keep bombing if they want. I mean, if they find targets of opportunity, they mow the grass, as they call it, all the time. I mean, when they stopped attacking Hezbollah, it wasn't like they were suddenly, if they saw targets, they were like, oh, we can't do that anymore. They didn't run out of money or momentum to hit Hezbollah. They didn't run out of money or momentum to hit Hamas. Why do we suddenly think that's different for the Iranians? Is there something magical about the Iranians that makes the Israelis stop?
Well, let me ask some. 46 years has been. But 46 years has been going on. There's never really been direct attacks until the last year between these two countries. Iran initiated the first two. This is the third one, and Israel clearly took action now on their own with our support.
Right.
So you have a point now where they lost their nuclear scientists, their commanders, their Quds Force leaders, then got to take it the next one, the next Quds Force leaders. The Ayatollah has never been more vulnerable. Every day that goes by, wouldn't you think that there would be a positive day that they survive as another day that they continue with their oppressive government who has one objective, and that's to destroy us in Israel?
Oh, look, if you're saying that we need a policy of regime change against Iran.
Well, let them make their own choice.
I wasn't making that argument, right? I'm just talking about Fordow, which is what the U.S. is considering. A policy of regime change cannot be brought about from the air. It can only be brought about.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it should be our policy for regime change. I would say it's our policy to wipe out Iran as a threat and then let the people decide. And what I think that could happen is
wiping them out as a threat. There are two ways to do that. This is kind of like talking about how do you destroy Hamas, right? I mean, you blow up Hamas, you blow up their leaders, you blow up their capabilities, but there's still a lot of people that are going to continue to volunteer for Hamas. you can kill the supreme leader. I feel quite confident the Americans and the Israelis would be able to do that. He's 85 years old. He's not super popular. They'll have a new supreme leader. You can kill their military leadership. That is by itself not going to end the regime. It will still feel like a military dictatorship that is implacably opposed to Israel and the United States. Regime change is going to require a much longer set of policies, and probably will require mm-hmm. some level of direct involvement on the ground, which the United mm-hmm. States understandably is incredibly reluctant
but,
to do.
But I'll tell you what, I haven't seen a pie chart on public sentiment that I would ever trust coming from the Iranian people.
Neither would I.
Yeah,
neither would I.
Right. But to me, if Fordo is as dangerous as they say, why would you allow them, if they are that close to a nuclear weapon, why would the longer you keep that intact with a desperate regime, the more chances that you have of it weaponizing, getting online, and there'll be some type of indirect or direct attack? Like, if it's that yeah. much of a threat, time yeah. is not on Israel's side or our side.
Well, so I would have accepted that argument before Israel engaged in all the strikes they've done over the last several days. That no longer holds true. It's not like these attacks have done no damage to Iran's nuclear capabilities. It's done massive damage. Israel has not yet hit Fordo above ground. They haven't yet taken that site offline. They can't destroy it, but they can take it offline. They have killed a lot of nuclear scientists. I'm sure they're going to go after more. That's not a job I would want if I were in Iran right now. They can't protect these people. That's also going to hurt them. The reason the Israelis haven't done that is because they really want the Americans to get involved. Of course they do. But that's not necessarily in America's interest. So I think that that's a really reasonable conversation to be having right now. And I'm telling you that on the balance of facts and mm-hmm. what we've seen over the last few days, I would not be recommending the United States taking out Fordo right now. But whether or not you agree with that, the point is it is clearly a third option. So presenting it as if there's only two options is crazy. It's obvious that the United States could push for let the Israelis be the bad cop. As the German chancellor said, the Israelis doing the dirty work for the NATO allies, and the Americans come in and give the Iranians battered, bloodied, with their nuclear program significantly degraded,
right.
give them one more chance for negotiations, which is what Trump has said he wants all the way along.
You make solid arguments, but to linger this, have this issue linger on, delaying the expansion of the Abraham Accords, allowing them to sell oil continuing to China at discount, that helps our, whether like it or not, our number one enemy in the world or rival, whatever you want to say, 90% of their oil sold to China. They continue to get it at a discount rate that keeps that economy going strong, which is a competition with us. That puts everything else on hold. The region can honestly say they're never going to go nuclear. They're going to go nuclear if Iran does. If they don't, we don't. So everything goes on hold in perpetual animation as we find out what's going to happen next. So the delay could result in suddenly Iran acting in a rational way, come in, we'll give up our nuclear program. I haven't seen any indication that they would act that way.
You now have a president in the United States who is the ultimate peacemaker, the ultimate dealmaker, self-appointed, better than anyone else in the world at getting to peace. Why won't you give that man a chance?
I thought we gave him six rounds, because you're not dealing with inaccurate. This is not the Browns against the Bengals.
You know what I mean.
Right. So it was fascinating debating, but good news is we're going to get an answer, and sadly you and I can't make the decision.
I think he's going to attack. I think that he's not going to listen to me.
Ian Bremmer, thanks so much. He predicts he's going to attack. Back in a moment. Always great.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fox's Brian Kilmeade, believe it or not, is launching a semi-pro soccer team on Long Island. Americans are calling it a stunning combination of things no one cares about. To boost attendance, Brian promised anyone who attends a game will not receive a copy of his book.
So that is very supportive of Greg Gutfeld.
I mean, it's how he shows his love towards you.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, does he... I mean, I just happened to look at that because I got home last night after hosting Laura Ingraham. I'm like, I can't sleep. I'm still wide awake. And I look up, I'm like, oh, the second story that he does on his monologue.
But I mean,
after the bombing in Iran.
There, that shows how much he wants to help people, like tell people to go and attend the soccer games.
Are you, did he ask you to spin that story?
Today? I think any publicity is good publicity. Now everyone knows
that's
that
my brother said,
your brother launched a really soccer team.
It's not about me. It's about my brother's team. I'm an investor in the team. He's doing it. He's working 80 hours a week. But they wrote the story in the Post, which is great. You can look at it online. They're the Tomcats right on Long Island. They're doing great, off to a great start. But Greg Gutfeld has no appreciation of soccer. He just doesn't.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
I think judging by the format, this is where I talk. Karl Rove is going to be on this hour. Don't ask me how I know. All right, it's on the rundown. And Martha McCallum will also be coming up when she can. She is on television right now. She'll be on her show at 3 o'clock. So much breaking news to follow. A lot going on. I know our Secretary of Defense is testifying. Can't watch all of it, along with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because I'm here. But I think he's about, you know, according to all reports, he's got a really good relationship with General Kurilla, and I think Kurilla, most of his requests are being fulfilled. I think that's great. I think there's got to be some trust within the Pentagon, the establishment, as well as the unique perspective, and I think it's a great perspective, our new Secretary of Defense. So before we get to Carl, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
On the SALT deduction, here's the challenge we face. Is it that $40,000 cap that's proposed by the House is a way that red states who have lower taxes and more restrained spending subsidize high-tax, high-spending blue states.
Big, beautiful bill kicking up dust in a bare-knuckle battle for compromise. I'm going to ask Carl about this.
Number two.
It's pretty clear what every single one of these Democrats is doing. What they want is their photo op. They want their headline, and they want the propaganda that feeds into their narrative. It's not working because all of the American people see right through it, and it's completely inauthentic.
That is Jessica Millen Patterson on Fox News at night. Immigration. President Trump has literally sealed the border. I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. And is calling an audible when it comes to illegals that are here, while literally Democrats are physically fighting for attention.
Number one.
This issue that in the end there would be this deep, deep underground uranium facility at Fordo that could only be taken out by a U.S. weapon. And we're now on the edge of that. Trump seems still uncertain what he wants to do. He should be uncertain. It's a big, big choice. One of the most consequential of his presidency.
And I really respect Dave Ignatius's breakdown always. It's on. And we may be in war with Israel and Iran. We might be involved. We're in the sixth day, and it looks like Trump is looking to finish what the IDF started, and the Grand Ayatollah is still talking tough and threatening for reprisals if we get directly involved while still asking for talks at the White House. Karl Rove joins us now. Karl, first off, from your perspective, with those years with Bush, I think six of the eight, how bloody are Iran's hands with American blood?
Well, horrific. And it goes back for, you know, essentially the entire reign of the Ayatollahs from 1978 on. And they view us as the devil, and they want the destruction of the United States. And let's be honest, a large reason that they want to have a nuclear weapon is in order to rain death and destruction on their enemies, of which we are the foremost. But yes, they've attacked U.S. servicemen in the region. They've attacked the West. They've attempted to kill Iranian dissidents in the United States. So anybody who thinks that the world is better off having the Ayatollah in command, and particularly if we were to give the Ayatollah a nuclear weapon, is kidding themselves.
600 plus dead during the Iraq War. They were responsible for 17%, and that's a conservative estimate of all deaths and injuries in the Iraq War. Without them, there probably isn't an effective insurgency in the Iraq War.
No.
We didn't plan on that. We didn't effectively respond as good as we could, as we eventually would, with the surge. But then you look at that and you go back to the 80s with Hezbollah, who they sponsored, and the Marine Barracks bombing and the Khobar Towers bombing in 96.
Right.
So anyone out there on the outside go, hey, this is not our war. Hey, America, don't get involved. Guys, pay attention. Spend a minute to get a perspective on what this country has meant to America.
Yeah. U.S. coal. You know, first of all, I'm not speaking to the neo-isolationists. They're stuck. They view a world with when Iran has a bomb as a place in which we will be able to, you know, live peacefully. Forget it. What we need to worry about and what we need to be focused on is convincing the American people who are not of that mindset that this matters to our country. And I think the president will find a ready audience for it. I mean, if you say to people, do you want to be involved in a war in the Middle East? They say no. But if you said, would you support the U.S. in a surgical strike, taking out a facility that is essential for Iran to have a nuclear weapon? They'd say, yeah, do it. And my sense is that that's exactly what the president is contemplating doing, is a surgical strike. I mean, this talk of we're going to be involved in a war in the Middle East. Exactly. We're not talking about it. The Israelis are not talking about it. I'm not aware of a single country in the Middle East that's talking about invading and occupying Iran. I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to, invade, be landing in Key West? No, but we will face a threat from them if this happens. If they lose their nuclear weapons program, they still have the ability to project their influence and power through terrorist activity around the globe, and we can count on them doing that. But hell, we can count on them doing that regardless of whether or not we take out the nuclear weapon.
Yeah, unconditional surrenders with the president saying no more ceasefire. That's why he got down on Macron. He's like, what are you talking about? The day of ceasefire are done. This has got to be a surrender. And we see how effective the Israelis have done. It's been unbelievable how good they are. I think the Ayatollahs just answered the president back in a tape message. And one of the words they used was U.S. intrusion would cause irreparable damage to us. And they called the president's words absurd rhetoric. So that's really not going to do anything to calm things down. The president did mention that the Iranians contacted him last night about getting talks going again. What would you do?
Well, look, first of all, this is the point at which, there's lots of been going on behind the scenes and out of public view, and that's important to the president's decision. And, we're not in a place where you and I can judge that. But it is clear three things. One is he has been very clear with the Iranians that his preference is to settle this issue by negotiation. Two, that those negotiations must end the nuclear program for all time. There must be a verifiable means of removing their capacity to do this, and they need to live up to it. And third, that he's serious. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. At 7:19 a.m. yesterday morning, in my inbox came a White House communications email. I'm assuming that it was sent to thousands upon thousands of journalists and columnists and so forth. Five pages of quotes, 15 of them from the president since he was inaugurated in January, 40 of them over the course mostly of the 2024 election, but stretching back to November of 2011, saying Iran must not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And the purpose of it, I suspect, was to say the president means it. And if he means it, he's going to have to act on it. I hope the threat of action is enough. But I think the response of the Ayatollah and his people yesterday and today is probably evidence that action must be taken.
That's a
serious decision, and it ought to be carefully thought out, discussed in the sit room over the next couple of days as a decision is made.
I love the fact too. The one thing is, Iran lost a huge ally in Syria. Russia is going to lose a supplier of their Shahed drones, and China will lose 90% of Iran's oil sales go to China. So they have both their belligerent attitude, terrible way of playing these negotiations have got them into this mess. And Israel's incredible actions taking out their commanders, their Quds Force leaders, their nuclear scientists, at least three of their nuclear facilities, that they've deserved full credit for all that. So they are backed into a corner right now. And the question, I think, militarily, strategically is, do we finish the job and send a message to our enemies the day of Afghanistan being the image of American retreat are over.
Yeah. And remember, in the first term of President Trump, one of the early moments that said he was serious about what he says was, remember Barack Obama said if Assad used gas on his people, that would be a red line? Well, very early on, Trump was asked the same question, and I have to admit I winced when he said, yes, it would be a red line for me, because I thought, here we go again with America being undermined if action is not taken. And Assad tested him by using gas on his people, and what did Trump do? He took out their capability of doing that. And my sense is that the prestige of the United States rose dramatically because people said, you know what, when Trump says something, he means it. And so he's going to act on it. So I think we're again in that situation. The Ayatollah and the people around him are testing the president. He has said no, Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. And I think they're trying to skate and hope that he doesn't really mean it. If he means it, again, it will be a strong message about America around the world. It will strengthen our hand in dealing with our adversaries, this axis of four countries, Russia, China, North Korea, and Tehran, which are today allied in a way that we have not faced since World War II in the cooperation between our adversaries.
And as you know better than anybody, the thing about World War II is Japan and Germany weren't working together. These four would be working together. They just believe this, and Italy, they just believe the same
thing.
They are.
They are. I mean, Italy was cooperating with the Germans in joint activity in Europe. But you're right. There was nothing like the seamless cooperation of North Korea supplying soldiers and munitions to Russia in return for missile and nuclear technology, or China buying the oil of Iran in order to give them an economic lifeline, or Tehran providing the drones that Russia is using to strike the Ukrainians. I mean, these people have an active program of mutual support and drawing on each other's strengths and helping to mitigate their weaknesses.
Yeah, and by the way, that's the lead editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Iran is Trump's deterrence model, could be for the next 3.5 years. But I want to go to another area of your expertise, and that's immigration. I think the president should take you up on his idea, your idea a month ago, to go down to the border and say, look what we did. I mean, literally zero admissions. We never thought we'd see this in our lifetime. Zero, all right? That's without finishing off the wall, getting the additional Border Patrol and ICE facilities. So now the president's in a situation where he's got to get out 660,000 estimated criminals here, some of which are back in Aurora, Colorado. Listen to the police chief. Says TDA has taken over more complexes. Cut 24.
Based upon everything that I stated here, based upon the involvement, the actions, the behaviors, the demeanor, there is without question gang involvement in this. And again, we are going to hold those individuals accountable.
We got to find a way. Now the president is president. He's not campaigning. If the local authorities are not going to have the ability and the state is not going to be willing to gut these people from taking over complexes, do you think this is a place for the National Guard?
Well, you know, look, this is a law enforcement issue. I'm not certain the guard is good at standing watch along the border. I'm not certain how good they are in, you know, moving into an apartment complex in Aurora, Colorado.
So what do you do if you're a Republican and a Democratic state?
Add additional capacity to ICE. Get local governments. There is a special program under our federal laws that allow local units of government, counties and cities and townships, for their law enforcement to actively cooperate with ICE. And more of those, I think it's 318, it's called. Those agreements, we ought to have more of those agreements. I hope the sheriff of Aurora, I know the mayor of Aurora, his attitude is we need to work with the federal government to deal with this crisis. Mm-hmm. So we need more of that. And when they don't do it, like the city of Chicago or the city of New York, then extra federal resources that will be made available by the passage of the reconciliation bill must be deployed to go after the criminal aliens. Now, I have a slight disagreement with the administration. I think the president was wise to briefly, I wish he had not flip-flopped on it, to say, look, we're not going to be worried about people who are here who have not violated the law except by the act of coming into the country, but have kept their nose clean in many instances for years or decades and are working in a packing plant or the hotel.
Can I help you here, Carl? I did speak to him yesterday about this, and I think it's a matter of communicating to his staff. He thoroughly believes hospitality as well as long-term farm workers, and he's trying to come up with a plan now. You know what I think happened? They've had so much success at the border. And I think they got to focus on the criminals. We both agree on that. They want to get the numbers up. I wouldn't worry about the numbers personally, but maybe they do. They now all of a sudden they're at the point I thought they'd be in 2.5 years where you can look around and go, okay, what do we do to expand the work visas? What do we do for the college first round draft picks? What do we do for the people that have been here 20 years? All of a sudden, an issue I thought we'd be dealing with in 2 years with a term limited president that could do a titanic immigration reform. I think it's upon us right now.
I agree. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the success at the border and shutting it down has been enormous. The success in going after the criminal aliens, I'd focus more of the resources there.
Exactly.
Look, every time you have somebody going into a packing plant and outside of, in western Kansas, or going into a farm community in Iowa, or going into a hotel in the Adirondacks, is people and wasted who could be otherwise focused on, let's go get the bad guys. Let's go get the people who have violated our laws, committed crimes against people and property, and get them out of the country.
I think, too, we talked about it, too, that having or owner of a farm, you got 16 people that have been working for you for 17 years. You get them a work visa. You don't get them a visa, citizenship, and then you're responsible for them. And then we work at something like that. Carl, we could do this every day. You and I should form our own think tank. We just got to figure out who else would be on the staff. We could really solve America's problems.
Maybe not. I'm speechless. this invitation from you I'm so grateful for the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Kilmeade. It's unbelievable.
Let's see who else. Maybe president or vice president. We'll see who gets staff up. Carl Rove, thanks so much.
You bet. All the best.
Back in a moment.
The fastest growing talk show in America. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we're back. Martha, fresh off your appearance on Fox News Channel. We're going to have a whole half hour together. But I also thought that would be a good opportunity to find out who's going to be in your show at 3. Do you know yet?
Well, Jack Keane is going to join us, and we're looking forward to, picking his brain about what he thinks is going on here and when he thinks the president may take action. We had a very interesting back and forth with the president, and we get to hear from him several times a day, which is pretty extraordinary, in the middle of all of this while he's figuring this out. And he said, maybe I will, maybe I won't. So I think that all indications right now seem to be moving in a forward momentum. He said, watch, it's going to be a very big week. He's dropping a lot of hints. So we'll see what happens. But I think it's an absolutely fascinating time to be in our business because we're watching something that is potentially so historic and actually is already moving in the extremely historic direction since the Abraham Accords. You're watching a shift in the Middle East that is very dramatic and historic. So everybody pay attention. It's
By
exciting.
The way, and like you don't see the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia,
Nothing.
Jordan. Jordan's king said, well, things got to keep this. A regional thing is going to get big. Whatever. You don't see. I think you see people waiting and watching because I think clearly there's a good guy, bad guy. And Israel is not, in this situation, looked at as the bad actor.
No, Saudi Arabia has said openly that they do see a future relationship with Israel. They see themselves as economic powerhouses. A lot of technology innovation in Israel, which, boy, we're seeing that play out in real time with these operations in many ways. And Saudi Arabia knows they have to move from oil into other industries. They see them as the brains in the operation in the Middle East and partners that they can work with. There's a long history of Israel working with partners in the Middle East. What changed was 1979. Prior to that, there were good relationships between Iranians and Israelis. They spoke the same languages. And I think we're looking at a period where we might be going back to that.
Yeah, I think we're going to find out what the Iranians think of their government, because they're going to have an opportunity to be heard for the first time.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I've been saying, oh, hell yes, for I think it's almost 6 weeks. Yeah. I think I might have been the first one to call, bomb, and destroy their nuclear facilities.
Yeah, Senator John Fetterman, all in. He also said, yeah, kill the Ayatollah. They killed Nasrallah, nothing happened. I don't care if he's a religious leader. He's a maniac, a genocidal maniac. At 85 years old, he just made another defiant speech, basically called the president's rhetoric irresponsible, or what did he say? Absurd rhetoric. Martha McCallum's here. Her show starts at 3 o'clock today, The Story. Senator Fetterman's been a breath of fresh air. Democrats have no idea what to do with him.
Nope.
Because they can't really alienate him. They need him. But there's no way he's singing their song.
I mean, in his own way, he's Trumpian, not in all of his political philosophy, but in his just ability. He just says what he thinks all the time. He's been a fascinating political story to watch because, you know, obviously there was a time when everyone thought he wasn't going to be able to function in the office due to his medical issues. But, you know, maybe one of the things, I think he's always been this way, but, you know, he's certainly, having been through all that, is not going to withhold his feelings on anything. And I think he's a very interesting, strong voice. I think that he's someone that they're going to be looking at very closely at as things move forward.
So we'll see. I think the president has got a little bit of an insurgency going with Tim Kaine and I guess Congressman Massey. They're looking to say...
What else is new?
Right. Who's teaming with the squad.
Right.
In order to try to stop the president for taking part directly in this war.
I don't think they have a leg to stand on. The thing that I think is very misunderstood at this point is that a strike is not entering into the war. Think about what the president did in Syria. It was also his first foreign action as president in the first term. And he brought in McMaster and Mattis at that point and talked to them. What are my options? You know, after we all saw the heinous biological weapons attack on children, he said, you know, look what they did to babies. And executed a strike. And I think that's the way to look at what we're talking about, at least right now, is that this is a strike. This is not America entering a forever war. Now, maybe down the road, those words become a stretch. But that's the way I view this right now. It's a strike, a capability that we have. I also am waiting for the Israelis who've been incredibly creative in this whole process. There are other ways. And I talked to the former ambassador to the UN from Israel the other day. There are other ways to cut off Fordo, potentially. So, and I'm sure that President Trump is open to hearing those as well.
Yeah. Right now they're talking about dropping two mother of all bombs or bunker busters, whatever you want to call it. They're 30,000 pounds. They could be dropped by a B-2 or a B-52. And they were telling me last night a C-150, if they were not in fear of, because it's so slow moving, if they're not in fear of defensive weapons or being struck down. Here's Brent Sadler. He's from the Heritage Foundation, former Navy captain. Cut two.
The Israelis have done this before in Syria. They've done it with other facilities around the world where they've had to go in and destroy a threat. This, however, is a completely different and a whole nother kind of category. So possible, yes. Risky, and given the chaos in Iran, there may be some thought given to it. But the best is if the Iranians capitulate and access is immediately assured for the Israelis to put boots on the ground, verify what's in there, and then destroy everything that they see at this site.
Because the Israelis not only have to say Iran's got to be taken out as a threat, if we wait years, Hamas gets refortified, Hezbollah gets supplied again. Right now, Lebanon's got a chance to be its own country. Gaza, as crazy as it is right now, is closer to wiping out Hamas than ever before. The Houthis could get starved because Iran could stop supplying them if this government changed complexions or philosophies. I don't think we should touch regime change. But if the Grand Ayatollah loses all his people and if he doesn't have a loyal army or police force, they'll change their own regime. That's the hope.
You know what? I remember covering a State of the Union address of George W. Bush, who talked in it about the axis of evil at that time. And he went through the list, North Korea, Iraq at that time, Iran, and he said that the strongest possibility in Iran, the way that it should happen, is an uprising by its people. These people, imagine what they have been going through since 1979. When they lived in this cosmopolitan environment, highly educated, women wore whatever they wanted, and then they wake up one day and the mullahs are policing them in the streets, telling them what they can wear, that they're not allowed to study. There is such a population in Iran. Many of them have left, but who would love to see them get their country back. He's never been more isolated than he is now. I think that, you know, we need to be supportive, which President Obama was not, of the people of Iran taking their country back.
Yeah, I guess we're going to see what's going to happen. But we also know that some of the retributions, let's go over that. We worry about our troops. They've indicated two different sources say the first troops that they would go after American forces would be Iraq. Then we have troops in Qatar. It's tough to get to, but that's a fortified base. Bahrain, we have troops there. We got troops, got a few hundred, 400, I think, in Syria. So they would certainly be vulnerable. We don't know what terrorists came through that might be sleeper cells that are here.
That's
also
true.
Axios wrote today about some type of cyber attack. They're pretty good at cyber, as we know. So these are the type of things that would fuel the MAGA base if you do it and you take out that facility and it's gone. And then all of a sudden our soldiers are under attack and we have some casualties or things of that nature. His right wing and left wing start going, Mr. President, you don't know what you're doing.
Here's what I would say. This, I don't think we can view this as a war that would be just beginning. Iran has been at war with us for many years, and they have done exactly the kind of things that you just cited, Brian. They have killed our military members across the Middle East. You can go all the way back to Beirut, to the Marine barracks attack. They have been after us for a very long time, and the way that they have succeeded in those attacks was through their proxies and through the infrastructure of their government and their leadership. But those things are decimated. Do not underestimate the impact of what Israel has pulled off against Hezbollah, against Hamas, against the Houthis. These groups are back on their heels. They might be worse than that at this point. And that's why this moment is very crucial, because you do have people in the Middle East in all of these areas who would really like a brighter future. They would like to have the economy that Israel has or that the Gulf states have, and that possibility exists. So, I might be overly optimistic, but I think we have to look at this moment. Moments in history pass by. They passed by Barack Obama in terms of what could have happened with the Iranian people and uprising. And there are a lot of people who believe we can't let that happen again.
This goes to show you that we don't understand their culture. I don't. If they actually said to themselves, let's be savvy. Let's tell Trump we're considering enriching uranium outside the country. We are considering stop spinning centrifuges. We're talking to different countries about how the UAE is setting it up. Trump would have probably went to the prime minister and go, listen, let's not bomb that. I'm making progress. We're in week six now in talks. So they're beginning. But instead they go, we're never going to stop. And then Biden comes out and says, hey, the Houthi rebels, not a terrorist nation. Mm-hmm. Israel, yeah, they are a little belligerent. Saudi Arabia, they're the problem. Let's talk. You know what they say? No, I'm not going to talk. So he actually made them look bad. He goes, I'll release some sanctions. You can sell oil. I'm going to look the other way. You can give those drones, those elite drones to help Russia turn around their fortunes in the war. I don't care. And they didn't talk to him. That was their opportunity for 4 years to take advantage of an addled president. Anthony Blinken, didn't know, to me, wasn't nearly strong. And Jake Sullivan just reeked of weakness. They didn't take any of that opportunity. So Trump comes in, and then they decide to talk with the tough guy?
You know.
Who didn't like them?
The Ayatollah said yesterday, you know, he scoffed at President Trump talking about unconditional surrender, exclamation point. And, you know, Trump went after him hard yesterday. We know where you are. We're not coming for you right now. We could take you out. And just in case there was any question about what he meant by that, in parentheses, kill, exclamation point. So it's no surprise that the Ayatollah came back with his own strong words today. He's saying something to the effect of, I guess you don't get us. You don't understand us. We don't surrender. But look at
what
where
you do. You're about to
is.
Lose. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I thought it was interesting, this other report in The Wall Street Journal today about how Israel's running low on arrow missiles. And, you know, we have to keep in mind, like, everybody is trying to work the situation to their advantage. Israel really wants us to be all in to give them everything that they need right now to pull this off. So, you know, there's a lot of dynamic, but I just keep going back to the fact that nobody is coming to their aid in Iran. He's 86 years old, this Ayatollah. His son, most people believe, is not capable of taking over for him. He runs the front office, as far as I can figure out. Raisi was supposed to be the person who was going to take his place. He died in a helicopter crash. This is an incredibly weak moment for the Iranian regime.
It is. Just real quick on immigration, the president of the United States wants to focus on the worst first. And suddenly we might have gotten off track in that. And now they're going to different workplaces and doing other things, causing some more controversy. And the president's getting some pushback, blowback from people I know he respects, senators in Iowa and what have you, including his Secretary of Agriculture, at which time he's looking at saying, hey, if you've been here, leave him alone. If you hospitality. And I thought, well, you put that out in the Truth Social, but that was late last week. What about this week? He goes, no, I haven't changed my mind. In fact, you know, you can't reward with citizenship because you came here illegally. But maybe there's a situation where the workers, the farmers, stand up for their workers, stand behind them, and you get them work visas. Don't ever give them citizenship. But then there's some type of accountability.
Exactly. Honestly, this is where Congress needs to step
in like that.
You know, I mean, this I thought was a really interesting development. All of a sudden on Friday, President Trump says, you know, well, a lot of these people have worked for these farms and worked in these hotels for like 20 years. And the owners and the people who manage them know them really well. And they may not have the right papers, but we should let them stay. And I thought, you know, this is a realistic perspective that is going to be music to the ears of a lot of businesses across this country. I mean, I often wondered why we didn't focus this effort. And I think a lot of it is focused on this when you look at the worst first. Mm-hmm. On, you know, if you came here over the last 4 years during this administration, you are all at the top of the list because you
flooded.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, why not look at the people who came in over the last 4 years, flooded across when the border did not exist. And, you know, you have not been here very long, but we're going to have to turn you around. You can take advantage of the CP1 program, which apparently now a million people have done. But if you put your focus on if you came in the last 4 years, we are starting with you. I think that might help.
First time in decades that more people are leaving than coming. In May of 2024, mm-hmm. 62,000 came under Biden. And that's with all his emergency measures. In May of 2025, zero. Zero. So the reason why, Martha, we're speaking like this is because the president has done something I didn't think was possible. He basically locked down the border already without the money for the new Border Patrol, military. They had such a great plan. It's down to zero. So now we look around and go, okay, now I could clean up this place. Now right. I could do the other stuff that takes people...
And
smart
this,
people.
Absolutely. And
rhetoric.
This is why the numbers are not where they want them to be, because the numbers that Biden got in the last 2 years were because they were dealing with people who were flooding across the border. They could go, you,
yeah.
and send them back. And that counts, right? Now you're dealing with people not who are crossing the border, because that problem is solved. It's been an extraordinary success. But you're dealing with people who are entrenched in communities, in society.
Yeah.
That's much tougher. It's a much tougher extraction, much tougher to figure out who the worst of the worst are. And that's why, you know, I think if you looked at people who came in the last few years, it would be maybe an easier focus. But it is tougher to run up those numbers given the fact that now they're dealing with people who are here.
Absolutely. So we're going to take a short time out. Martha, we know we have General Keane coming up at 3 o'clock, some other guests. We're still following.
We're going to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis as well, retired U.S. Army officer, airborne ranger. We're going to lots of preparation and lots of writing he's done about the potential for World War III. So we'll talk to him about that.
Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
As an immigrant yourself, you are an immigrant. You're an immigrant in this country.
Yeah.
Did you have a visceral reaction to what they're doing, what ICE is doing, when you see the videos of it?
We got to do things legal. That is the important thing, you know. So you got to do things legal. And those people that are doing illegal things in America, and they're the foreigners, they are not smart. Because when you come to America, you're a guest, and you have to behave like a guest. I'm so happy to see firsthand that this is the greatest country in the world, and this is the land of opportunity.
So that is President, the former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, talking about the country. Do you notice, Martha McCallum, that he does not rip Trump? They book him to be anti-Trump.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do it anymore. And unless he actually has to, even though they disagree, especially on green energy.
Yeah.
He goes out of his way to just say, leave me out of this. And that got the view ticked off. You saw a hand reach out and try to tap him while tapping him out.
That's enough, Arnold. No, I mean, he's another person I appreciate because he is who he is. He says what he thinks. He doesn't care what anyone else thinks. He's not trying to please anybody. And he worked his butt off, all of his parts of his body, becoming a champion.
Literally physically, 8 hours a day.
Yeah, and I just love the moment of him sitting there and looking at them and saying, well, you're a guest in this country. They're just like, they look like, you know, they're like wires were going to start coming out of their heads. Like, wait, what? I'm imploding. I don't even know how to respond to this. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, for me, I think he's obviously saying, I feel much more comfortable as a Republican after I witnessed 4 years of Joe Biden. So I want Joe Biden, you know, Donald Trump's worthy. He's not worthy of the job, and Hillary Clinton would have been bad. There was a theory out there. And then you witnessed what happened for 4 years, the way the pandemic was handled, the lack of meritocracy, the political correctness. How could Arnold Schwarzenegger ever feel comfortable in that environment? That's against everything that he's about.
Absolutely.
People get caught up in his personal life and what he did. Yeah, he made mistakes, like especially a lot of stars in Hollywood. But he physically outworked everybody. And then he made the impossible transition to action star and becoming a producer.
No, he has an extraordinary professional story. And as you point out, it's, you know, has its bumps along the road in terms of his personal life. But I think it's refreshing to see someone sit in the middle of that table and just say what they think from their heart about the country and have them all look like they don't know what to do with it. Like they want to shut him up. I mean, yes, it's true. Any one of us, when you go to any other country, right, you feel like a guest.
Absolutely.
In that country.
Yeah.
You know that you have to have your passport and your documentation to get there. And you know that if it's a visa country, you only have a certain amount of time that you're allowed to stay. For some reason, those rules completely fell apart in this country for a very long time. And it's backwards. It makes no sense. And I think Arnold's speaking the truth to the power at the old View table.
I know a lot of times you say, Brian, let's get our families together over the weekend. And I'm just going to beat you to the punch. I'm busy.
Oh,
I know. I'm going to be in Dayton.
I think you don't like my family, maybe.
I think it's, I like your family. It's you and I clash off camera. No, I'm only kidding. But I'm going to be in Dayton, Ohio with Fox Nation, with History, Liberty, and Laughs on stage. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, a few tickets left. And then on the 23rd in Dallas, Texas, same address. We got 2,000 seats to fill up, and then in Richmond, Virginia on the 27th. So if
that's
you have
awesome.
Free at all.
That's fantastic.
Were you going to be in Dayton anyway?
No, actually, not in Dayton, but perhaps I'll catch you down the road. It's going to be a huge success.
Home of the Wright Brothers.
Home of the Wright Brothers.
They had a bike shop, but yet they learned how to fly.
They were out Long Island, I thought, and down in,
No, that was Roosevelt Field.
Oh, okay.
I think that's where Lindbergh first landed.
Oh.
Very similar.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. That's very World War II-esque. That's typical Martha McCallum.
Thank you.
As America prepares for its 249th birthday on July 4th, Fox News Podcasts celebrates great Americans, highlighting well-known and everyday folks who've made their mark on the country in their own special way. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com.